and welcome to the Thinking Fellows. My name is Caleb, and I am once again joined by John Hoyam and Kelsey Clembera. We are doing a second episode of the Junior Fellows tackling some questions. But before we dive into that, I just wanted to highlight some of the things going on at 1517 right now. You know, we have some new podcasts coming out this week, the week of this episode coming out. We have Luther's Outlaw God, which I am very excited about because I've been working on this podcast for several months. The Outlaw God podcast is going to be featuring Steve Paulson. I've been recording that with him for the past like 15 weeks or something like that. And we finally got to announce it a couple of weeks ago. The first episode is already out if you're listening to this episode. So you can go to your favorite podcasting app and you can find the Outlaw God there. It'll also be floating around Twitter and Facebook from our various channels this week as well. It's going to be a good show. It's loosely based off the theme of Paulson's Luther's Outlaw God, Volumes 1 through eventually 3 here pretty soon, but Volumes 1 and 2 are available now. And we diverge and elaborate farther than the book goes in some circumstances. And so far, it's been a lot of fun. The episodes are slightly shorter than the Thinking Fellows, so it's a little bit less of a commitment if your commute to work is shorter or something like that. It's about a 30-minute show. And again, you can check that out either at 1517.org under the podcast tab or on your favorite podcasting app. Okay, guys, today is going to be a fun topic because this is one I like talking about a lot, mostly because, you know, 2 years ago, did a lot of work on it. And Kelsey did a lot of work on it with me. I think last episode we talked about the little book that 1517 published at the Here We Still Stand conference in 2018, which was called The Theology of the Cross, which included a new translation of the theological theses of Martin Luther's Heidelberg Disputation in it, which I did and worked on for several months and then worked through a lot of edits on. And then we included, so we paired up the theses, and then we included short essays on each of those pairings, which Kelsey then edited all of those and arranged and worked with the authors on those. And I think it came out really well. I think it's a really good introductory book to the Heidelberg Disputation in general and what's going on there. In my translation, I tried to deal with both some of the woodenness of the older translation that has been used, but also some of the apparent translation errors. Like there was an error identified in Thesis 19 that I worked with as well. So, and just tried to make it go smoothly. But today we're going to go talk about the theology of the cross and theology of glory again, because there's been some recent conversation on whether or not the categories are helpful at all, particularly the theology of glory category. Is it a helpful category? And what is the category? Is it a prohibition against glory generally? Because that is the negative side of the theses here. So when you talk about the theology of the cross and the theology of glory, the theology of the cross and is the supposed good one, right? It's the theology you want to be associated with. And the theology of glory is the apparent bad one. It's the one you don't want to be associated with. And one of the problems that has been talked about is, well, isn't God glorious? So if you're making glory a bad thing, is this a helpful category? Should we use glory negatively? So what do you guys think about this issue?
I mean, I think it's a helpful and necessary category if we're especially talking about as Luther does, being a theologian of the cross, which is something that is good, means that basically God is revealing himself to us through the cross of Christ. That's where he has promised to be found and where he has promised to justify us. Then it makes sense that there would need to be a negative version of that we need to be aware of. So this would be a theologian of glory or the theology of glory. And as Caleb kind of said already, I don't think that means that we're saying that God's glory is a bad thing. Obviously, that's very biblical. The way that Luther's using this term is to get us to think about our glory projects, and the way that we attempt to glorify ourselves, justify ourselves in ourselves, rather than going to Christ on the cross for our justification.
I would say even to use God's glorious attributes like virtue, goodness, and justice as our primary means of accessing him and engaging in a relationship with him, right, is part of that, right? Is what do you use, what knowledge from God do you use to be in right standing with him? And the cross or glory distinction says, well, you either access God through the cross or you access him through glory. If we're just going to answer that question, can we access God through glory? Or if we can, where does that leave us?
I think there's two different things kind of going on. One is the question of the divine majesty, which is maybe a little bit different from God's glory. But the way that this theme of divine majesty appears in Luther's writings is that the divine majesty is God in himself, apart from any means of grace, apart from any proclamation, apart from any message, apart from the incarnation. So the divine majesty may be very glorious, but the divine majesty is also something that is dangerous. Incidentally, you'll notice that this theme of cross and glory has an adjustment made to it when you get to the bondage of the will in 1525, 7 years after Heidelberg. So I think that the question of the divine majesty is one thing, but the other matter is, what is God's proper glory? And I think the broader kind of point is no, we're not against glory. What we're saying is that God's proper glory is something that we did not expect, something that our reason does not innately grasp or understand. But God's proper glory is the gift of himself to us in Jesus Christ. And so the cross itself is a sort of glory, but the juxtaposition of glory and cross, at least in Heidelberg, is kind of its own thing. But so I guess that's a yes and no answer.
One of the interesting questions, and I think it's the one that has to be sort of dealt with anybody who reads with this. I spent a little time on it in my preface. Others have done larger work on this. But the question is this a useful category, since it seems to mostly disappear in Luther's writings later on, right? The distinction between the theology of the cross and the theology of glory is not abundant in Luther's writings, word for word, after Heidelberg. So does that affect whether we think that this is a useful thing, or should we just say, oh, he did it, it's a piece of Lutheran history, but it turns out it wasn't useful?
Well, I'm not entirely certain that that's true, that it disappears from Luther's writings. In terms of the terminology of the theology of the cross is sparse after Heidelberg. However, that doesn't mean that it disappears. It simply means that it appears under different thematic names and different types of uses. And we have to remember that Luther writes with a variety of kind of genres, right? And so he will use various themes or ideas from his preaching and from his theological work in various different ways across his writings and over the years, simply because his audience was changing frequently, and he used a lot of different genres of expression. And so I don't think that the disappearance of the term the theology of the cross means all that much. The question is, does the framework itself, even if it's not named, does the framework itself endure? And at least to my mind, the answer is yes. I could go into that. But.
Yeah, I mean, I think I tend to agree with you because of, I mean, at the end of the day, if we boil it down to its simplest parts, this is about accessing God and accessing salvation, which is a question that never disappears. And so we can look at the theology of the cross and the theology of glory and say, is this consistent with the way Lutherans talk about access of God and access salvation later on? And I think the answer to that is yes. I think primarily you see this in the distinction between the law and the gospel, between God preached, and I think as Paulson does a really good job of showing out, God hidden and God revealed in that preaching. And you see those distinctions maintained. I think you see it, that distinction, even in Melanchthon, especially in the 1521 Loci. There's a lot of similarity between the theology of the cross and theology of glory and the way that Melanchthon talks about the command and the promise and the effects of the command and the promise and how one receives both of those things, both similarly and differently. And so I think it's evident that the question, can I access God, number one, through my own acts of glory, and number two, through his glory. And I think that's what the theology of glory really condemns. It appears to me, both in Heidelberg, and I think Ferdy's on Being a Theologian of the Cross, if it does one thing really well, and it's preach the first commandment, it is a preaching against other gods, namely yourself and your works, and that is what the Heidelberg Disputation does as well. It is a brutal preaching of the first commandment. Where is your faith? Is it in these invisible things of God and then the way that you can align your will with the invisible things of God? Or is your faith in the foolishness and weakness of God revealed in the cross and Christ's suffering and death?
Yeah, because I think just to reiterate what happens when you are trying to self-justify through God's glory before you are the cross is that you are misinterpreting that glory. You're taking it for your own use. You're assuming that it's something that can give you power instead of looking to where God has chosen to reveal himself, which is like Caleb said, in the weakness and foolishness of Christ crucified.
Right. You know, thesis 19 and 20 are really important pair here, because this is thesis 19 is where the theologian of the cross starts to show up. So Luther says,
and you're speaking about the Heidelberg Disputation, just to clarify for people.
Correct. Right. Yeah. So it says that that person is not worthy to be called a theologian who thinks the invisible things of God are observable from events which have actually happened. So it talks about, and in an earlier thesis, Martin Luther talks about natural law and its usefulness and its lack of usefulness towards obtaining salvation. But here he goes then in on 20. So these are really a pair. I mean, they don't have a massively separate theme. So then it goes, conversely, a person is worthy of being called a theologian who understands the visible and ordered things of God after fixing his sight on the passion and cross of Christ. So what you have here is not a denial that God's attributes are knowable from things which occur in nature. Or this is not a denial that there is a natural law. It's a limitation on what the invisible things of God can gain you and what you actually need in order to place those invisible, or what we would call the attributes of God, in their right place. And, you know, Luther goes on, and this especially comes out in the law and gospel distinction later, that those attributes of God are nothing but condemnation to the person outside of the cross. They do not make you worthy of God or wise to attain God, is what we see in the proof of thesis 19. And he goes on to say that God determined to be known through the foolishness of Christ, to be to be known through the cross. And so really this is a question about how good is knowledge for you? And it's not a question of whether or not this knowledge is actually there, which I think is one of the things where if somebody was using this perhaps too loosely or too generally, would be to say, well, look, at Luther says there is nothing to know about God from nature. And I do think it is good to be careful and say that's not what's actually being pronounced here. It's a question of what can that be used towards any useful ends.
Yeah. And that's just echoing Romans 1, right? Mm-hmm. Where Paul says that, you know, we can see God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature. We have seen them, and yet we still turn away. So even more so, we need something else. We need God to reveal himself in some other way in order to save us, because this is not cutting it.
And what I think is great about Romans 1 and 2, chapters 1 through 3, really, is that Paul then asks the question, well, what about the people who had these things of God revealed to them directly through the word, through the Decalogue? To what, he asked directly, to what advantage is the Jew who had the law? And apart from Christ, he's not at an advantage. Knowing God's attributes either from nature or from the Decalogue are of no advantage to you apart from Christ.
Yeah, Paul's whole argument in those first few chapters of Romans is to essentially prosecute everyone, Jew and Gentile, righteous and sinful, to show how, in fact, we all in some way are accountable to God because we have a knowledge of his will from creation. But we did not celebrate this or use this correctly as if it was going to make us righteous, but people have instead used the law simply as an occasion for sin. And of course, this fits within Paul's broader argument that the law is ultimately powerless to give us salvation. It can do many things well, especially show us our sin and reveal this condition. But simply having the knowledge of God's attributes from nature is of no final or saving help for us. And that's an integral piece of the entire argument in Romans.
Yeah, it's I think it's why the categories, have been important to recover and are still helpful, because this is, I think, in the age of postmodernism, natural law's new prevalence as sort of an answer to what seems like sort of moral, just ambiguity in culture, is to go back to natural law, which I don't have a problem with natural law and being helpful in crafting a social or political ethic. I mean, our Constitution quite literally testifies to natural revelation, right? About even our rights being endowed in nature. So, but when you start to let that creep in on your theology, then what makes for a good and ordered society actually doesn't make for a saved person. You actually can get into, I think, a sticky type of universalism, right? Where a person who's aligned with nature is the person who is saved. And, if you follow the religions of the world, most of them have a vague attempt to be ethical, and they get similar to Christianity. It's undeniable that, particularly Judaism, right, would be the really hard one to explain, because they have the Decalogue revealed in the same manner that we do. Islam has very similar set of, ethical restrictions and historical heritage to the Abrahamic faith, as it's called, right? So you have an issue if saved by doing, why us and why not the other religions of the world who get 90% of the way there?
Or even saved by God's glory.
Right.
Because they believe in a glorious God.
Oh, yeah, in a massively sovereign one, right? I mean, Islam in particular extraordinarily highlights God's sovereignty and control over the world. If that divine goodness and control of God and knowing that is what saves you, then it's not just Christians who are going to be saved. So I think, I mean, I guess one of the things that is it helpful for people going around and like calling stuff a theology of glory and a theology of the cross regularly? Is it helpful for us to say, well, that's a theology of glory to something that somebody's doing or saying, in today's theology, or is it simply is it more helpful as a category that we just sort of know and hold on to, or should we use it as a public category still?
I'm going to speak just personally.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it is. It can be extremely helpful. I think specifically for an American Christian who maybe comes from a more evangelical background, the way that these categories kind of are defined and the distinction that's being made that we're talking about here between man's glory and Christ crucified is very, very helpful, because I think that there's something very relatable about the category. That's not the end all be all to use it. I know that, but I do think that it is a very helpful distinction for someone who's grown up being told that they have to work to earn God's favor. I think it's a good way to kind of break that down for people.
I think I find it in part helpful in our current age, because man, with technological advancement, our glory, quote unquote, is more apparent than ever, right? Like our ability to achieve, to sustain human life, to do the right things, you have more options. I think Dave Zoll's book, Seculosity, gets at this, I think, really well, right? You have more options to do the right things that'll improve your life, both socially and physically, than you've ever had before, right? You can do all sorts of right things, down to your diet, down to the way you treat your kids, down to the psychology you include in the home and the way you approach work. All of these things have a massively earning aspect of them, right? And our entire lives are made up of these things, which are in part a necessity, right? Like grades are a regular and often essential part of education. There is a type of earning there that goes with that, where the knowledge that you've gained quite literally earns you a better spot, a better grade. And so there's a very natural and essential part of the way we live. And so it's good to point out that that can't bleed in over to faith. And it's really easy to bleed in on a whole spectrum of things. I think one of the misnomers is like that this would apply to both conservative and liberal politics, for instance, that they both have theologies of glory incorporated into them. Even if you as an individual were able to say that one was right or one was wrong for a myriad of reasons, that both of these are implicit in a system of glory and gain.
I think it's crucial to point out, you know, I agree with both of you that it is a helpful category or set of categories to use today, especially in our modern American kind of civil religious context. But there is a certain kind of, I guess I would call it manualist Lutheranism, which says, well, if a specific category or distinction does not appear in our confessional documents, mm-hmm. If it doesn't appear in the Book of Concord, or maybe if it doesn't appear in the great dogmatic texts of scholastic Lutherans or 19th century, you know, scholastic revivalists, if a distinction doesn't appear in those books, then we really don't, we maybe shouldn't use it. We don't have to use it, or, you know, that'll be the argument that gets kind of deployed. And of course, it goes back to the question of, you know, does the distinction between theologian of glory, theologian of the cross, and Dior and Luther, even if the name does not. But I think that's an important piece to bring up is that there will be some who will object to the use of this distinction simply because it's not used in the confessions explicitly or in the great dogmatics texts.
I mean, I think one of the great examples of where that starts to fall short is the simile, right? It does not show up directly in the confessions. But Article 6 of the Formula Concord, for instance, predicates the necessity of continuing to preach the law to the Christian on the fact that in this life, the Christian is not wholly perfected and remains sinful, that the old creature is still there. And so, you know, I think you might be able to do some mental jumping jacks to get that to not be the simile, but that is certainly a spot where somebody could say this category of simultaneously righteous and sinner is actually there and important.
Yeah, there's a great irony to the fact that the best and most explicit, you know, documentation of the simile in the confessions is in Article 6 of the formula.
Right, there is.
Which is a dimension of that article that is not appreciated frequently enough.
Yeah, and it's very early in there. I mean, it's part of the question. I mean, a lot of the confessions in general, and even, you know, disputations like this, are responding to questions in particular. So this question that appears here is why the law for those who have been declared righteous? Why then the law? And the Heidelberg disputation asks the question sort of sarcastically to you know, this group of Augustinians who Luther is essentially accusing of seeking to access God purely through nature and through his glory, his divine glory. Why then the cross? Why then the cross? What is the cross? Is it an extension of God's glory? Or is it something totally different? And Heidelberg disputation starts to get at that totally different, right? That this is where the one is the strength of God and his mighty majesty, this is his weakness and foolishness. And I think that's, it's probably offensive, right, to say that there is weakness and foolishness in what God does. But it's in scripture. It's there.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is maybe a little bit of an aside, but we've got to be careful to not become so obsessed with which categories and what names and like the systematizing of theology that we forget the content of theology itself. And I think that that becomes a lot of times the focus of, if we're arguing about these things, it's the organization of things rather than the content. And if you can point back to scripture and say the content is there, and we might call it something else, but if the category is helpful in that sense to bring us to God's word, then it's helpful.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point with regard to the confessions as well. I mean, the sort of classic confessional Lutheran point about the confessions is that we don't subscribe to the sort of various details of the texts themselves, but we subscribe to the doctrinal content. So does the slogan theology of the cross appear in the confessions? No, but is it a part of the content? I would say absolutely. Same with the simile, same with preached God, unpreached God.
Yeah.
Things that are not mentioned explicitly, but are they part of the doctrinal content? I would say for sure.
Yeah, I think, you know, that's what I was trying to get at the beginning, is the question of how is God found, where is God accessed, how do sinners get to God, never goes away. That was with them continuously during the Reformation, and it is with us continuously now. It is a matter that will always weigh on people's consciences, and it's something that we have to be ready to preach for, to preach to. I think that's, in particular, that's why I don't think in general there is damage here being done to the reputation of glory, or the fact that we will even be glorified, right? It is not about, this is not saying or proclaiming, and I don't think in Heidelberg or by Ferdy, or I don't think in our little booklet in any of the chapters, that being glorified by God is a bad thing, or that the glory of God is not something that we can admire. It is simply trying to place it in the right spot so that the glory of God does not become your damnation, which is exactly what it is apart from the gospel, right? The law is nothing but your damnation apart from the gospel.
Yeah, and also that the glory of the Christian doesn't become your salvation.
Right. Right. Yeah, you aren't... glorification is a part, is a benefit of the promise. It is not the way you've obtained the promise. And so, again, sort of like the episode with that we just did with works and stuff, there can be a mix-up of, is it the chicken or the egg? What came first, glory or justification? What comes first? Goodwill, which then produces works, or again, justification, which is one a result of the promise, or is one making the promise true? And it's just a thing that can be slipped into too, right? I think this isn't even always intentional. I think that's part of Luther's point here with a lot of this, is like, this is why we have to intentionally preach the law in all its fullness and the gospel in all its fullness, because at the end of the day, we're lazy. And we will slip back into old habits with this new language and justify old habits in new ways. There's one other aspect of this I really want to approach, and that is a use of the theology of the cross, which I think misunderstands what is being said by suffering here. So there's an emphasis on the theology of the cross, on Christ's suffering for us. But there is a trend to then make the distinction between a theologian of glory and the theologian of cross one of the person who is suffering or the person who has not suffered, right? And so you can say, well, the person who has suffered for and with Christ, or has suffered in general, has a life that testifies to suffering, is a theologian of the cross. And the person who has done well in life, who is ethical, who has not had a major pitfall in their life, who's managed their money well, goes to church every Sunday and is proud of it, and that kind of thing, well, they've done well and they have not suffered, so they must be a theologian of glory. I think that's problematic. I don't think that's what this is getting at all. John, you have something on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the gospel is not just the opposite of the world's values. It's not just the opposite of common sense or whatever. It's not just the opposite of beauty. It's not just the negation of everything that sinners or sort of the natural world values. It's not the opposite. It's actually something else. It's something from outside of the entire arrangement. And so the problem with what you're describing, which is a reverse theology of glory or reverse theology of the cross, however you want to name it. But the problem with it is that it retains the same basic structure of, you know, how things work. You just prioritize different things. I mean, the way that Steve Paulson will describe this is, he will say, you still have the basic framework of the law, even if you just turn it upside down. And so glorifying the things that the world finds ugly for its own sake, or to say that you become righteous by participating in activities, you know, thought to be bad, is, you still have the same problem of the legal scheme of justification through your good works, but it's just turned upside down. And that's no help. The gospel, you know, finally comes to us from the outside. So it's actually much more dangerous and much more radical than just turning the world on its head.
Yeah, the gospel is a wholly different word, right? It is not an evolution of the law, or a different side of that piece, that dice. It is it is completely different word from God. And so I think one of the things to note here is that, you know, if a group of people who are looking to their suffering as the test, their personal suffering as a testifying of faith, right, are still looking at them for that assurance of faith. Back to that same thing. There, it is not about that external application of the word. It is about then how that affected me personally. And you get a flavor of this that's very psychological, right? Like where the law is the thing that makes me feel bad and the gospel is the thing that makes me feel good. Well, that actually doesn't work out, because there are times where somebody might preach some aspect of the law that you feel like you've done and you've done really well, and that's going to make you feel good, right? The way you feel inside is not a testimony to what God has said or what God has done. It actually comes from outside of you.
Yeah, the law is a word of divine wrath, judging sin, even if you've somehow convinced yourself that you like it, like the early sort of Augustinian monastic Luther, who was trying to find some sort of love for God inside his own self, you know, mortification.
Right.
And, you know, you're just kind of back at the same place if you reduce these objective realities of law and gospel, or glory and suffering, if you make them emotions or sort of interior psychological experiences instead of objective creaturely earthly things that God is going to make use of, then you're sort of in the same place you were at before.
Well, if the theology of the cross is about suffering rightly, Luther would have never been condemning Augustinians, Augustinian monks with the theology of the cross. He would have said, good job, boys, you did it. You suffered for Jesus.
Yeah.
So, well, guys, I mean, we're at time again, unless there's anything else to note here. I think Kelsey's reminder that when employing systematic categories in, for lack of a better word, pastoral theology or personally doing theology with people, you have to be careful, right? It's preaching the category is a careful thing to do. And this is really just about, like, the theology of cross would demand that you preach Christ crucified for the forgiveness of sin, not that you preach the theology of the cross, right? So that's one of the issues at hand here. And if you too readily just keep calling somebody like a theologian of glory, for instance, there might actually be a better way, if you need to preach the law to somebody, to do that, which is if you need to condemn somebody with the law, let's do what Luther does here and just use the full force of the law. Preach the law. Don't just name the law something else like glory and use that as a proxy.
Yeah, that's good.
So, all right, guys. Well, hey, just a reminder to the listeners, if you'd like to support the show, you can either go to 1517.org/donate and set up a small monthly recurring donation. We do appreciate that. And I do understand that a lot of people are going through financial hardship right now. Our nation, you know, was hit with a pandemic and economic unrest. And so if that's not possible at the moment, please just consider it for the future if it does become possible at some time. And as well, you can go and rate the Thinking Fellows on Apple Podcasts. Link will be in the top of the show notes there. And do remember to check out some of the new podcasts coming out, including Luther's Outlaw God, out this week. So thanks for listening, guys. We'll catch you next time. Bye.